Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. It's been almost 3 years since the publication of Harper Lee's previously unknown novel, Go Set a Watchman, sparked a national uproar. Lee's legion of fans were thrilled when they learned that her estate had granted HarperCollins the rights to publish the second novel, which features a number of the same characters that appeared in Mockingbird. But many people were dismayed when they read the very different portrayal of Atticus Finch as he appears in Watchmen. In To Kill a Mockingbird, of course, Atticus Finch is a hero. He defends Tom Robinson, the black man accused of rape, and incurs the hostility of much of the white community in the town of Macomb, Alabama. At the same time, in Mockingbird, Atticus teaches his children that all men and women deserve justice and fair treatment.
There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town. I couldn't even tell you or Jim not to do something again. You're going to hear some ugly talk about this in school. But I want you to promise me one thing. That you won't get into fights over it. No matter what they say to you.
Yes.
That's Gregory Peck as Atticus and Mary Badham as Scout in the 1962 movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird. But in Go Set a Watchman, Lee makes Atticus Finch a member of the racist White Citizens Council and establishes him as an avowed segregationist. And it was that portrayal of him which upset so many who had always seen Atticus as an embodiment of social justice during a dark era in the South. Now, the planned Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird is creating a new controversy. The estate of Harper Lee is suing to stop production because in the script, Atticus Finch is shown as a man who begins the play in agreement with the views of the arch segregationists around him. Ironically, that's just how he's portrayed in Go Set a Watchman, but the estate claims the play must be true simply to the story in Mockingbird without regard to the second novel. Legal arguments aside, the concerns over how to portray Atticus Finch are really a part of a much larger question Southerners have wrestled with for many, many years. How do we reconcile the awful truth about the history of the Old South with the people we aspire to be today? That question was at the heart of a conversation I had on this show when Go Set a Watchman was published in 2015. My guests were Chuck Reese. He's a native Georgian and is the editor of The Bitter Southerner. Chuck joins us a little later in the show. First, Joe Crispino. He's from Mississippi and is the Jimmy Carter Professor of Southern American and American History at Emory University. Were you eager to pick up Go Set a Watchman?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was really excited to see what was going to happen with Atticus Finch in the 1950s. And of course, you know, you say that kind of playfully because you know this book, we assume from reports that this book was written prior to Kill a Mockingbird. And yet still, you recognize the character of Atticus, and I think there are great kind of continuities between the two.
You wrote a very interesting piece for the New York Times about your reaction to Go Set a Watchman. Were you shocked, as many people were, by the depiction of Atticus Finch in the newly published Harper Lee book as opposed to Kill a Mockingbird?
No, I wasn't shocked. In some ways, I was relieved. I felt like, as I said in the piece, Atticus Finch has been an overburdened figure in our culture for a long time, and he's had to bear too much kind of responsibility for the good South and the noble Southerners, and too much emphasis has been placed on that. So I thought this was a fascinating kind of primary source document that gets you into the kind of tumult of the 1950s in an era of intense political reaction across the region. And that Atticus Finch responded to the Brown decision and to the challenges of those periods in a way that the vast majority of white Southerners did.
Even
people who might be called liberals by their community in those days, white liberals responded that way.
Well, yeah, and you see in the novel, Atticus invested in kind of preserving a certain racial status quo, but also in trying to preserve the peace within the white community, right? The people like Atticus Finch, people who would have been considered progressive Southerners in the 30s and 40s, were in the 50s worried about a certain kind of violent extremist element, you know, coming to the fore, and therefore they would have adjusted themselves accordingly to try to maintain control over the community and to prevent, and that's where the way a lot of those citizens' councils operated. That's the story they told themselves, which is that, look, we're the responsible sorts in these communities. If we weren't taking the lead on this, then the Klan and other extremist groups would, and therefore we are the responsible, dignified leadership that is going to respond to the court and to these demands that are being made.
You know, one example of that in Go Set a Watchman is that Jean Louise, Scout, mm-hmm. as a young girl, had believed that her father defended Tom Robinson, the black man accused of rape, because he believed in justice for all. And to some extent, he may have believed in justice for all. But what we learn in Go Set a Watchman is that one of the reasons Atticus Finch defended him was he wanted to keep the NAACP and other black rabble-rousers away from the courts in Alabama, right?
Right. No, that's a really important kind of revelation in this book that really, and people, I think, who had commented on Mockingbird, you know, knew that and kind of understood that, but we never got that side of Atticus. We never got the kind of what, you know, some people would have called the smart segregationist, right? There, Atticus Finch was a kind of smart segregationist, and there was a whole genre of them in the 30s and 40s, folks who were politically astute and knew that if they were going to preserve the racial status quo in the South, if they were going to preserve segregation, then they would have to take certain steps to better accommodate it, you know, to better accommodate the demands that were being made. For example, in the years before the Brown decision, in the early 1950s, you know, the Brown decision was in the courts for many years. Southerners knew that it was coming, and they were afraid that the court was going to strike down segregation. So the most forward-looking segregationists actually went about to try to equalize black schools, to bring them up to the level of white schools, because they had been treated, you know, they had been underfunded for decades, and they were in horrible condition compared to white schools. And so in the state of South Carolina, the governor, James Burns, there passes a huge piece of legislation involved tax increases to fund what they would have called at the time Negro schools to try to bring them up to the level of white schools, because they knew that under the doctrine of separate but equal, which was the Plessy doctrine, Plessy versus Ferguson back in the late 19th century, there was not separate but equal in the South, that schools were not equal. So they were trying to preserve schools by equalizing them under the Plessy doctrine. And in the end, the courts, you know, threw out the whole idea of separate but equal in the Brown decision.
Atticus also, in the confrontation scene that he has with his daughter, he talks about, he believes in states' rights. Atticus Finch represents that white Southerner who felt the intrusion of the federal government was wrong, was an attempt to take over state politics. I mean, He is a defender of states' rights. I'm not quite sure what we make of that as we look back on that period of history today and read Harper Lee talking about it that way.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the character of Atticus in Go Set a Watchman, he has a whole trajectory, political trajectory, that we see nothing about in Mockingbird. In Mockingbird, we see a man who believes that everybody deserves justice before the law and that Tom Robinson deserves good representation, and he's going to give him that representation. And that's what a good lawyer does. We see nothing really about the broader context of the New Deal or Southern politics or things that are going on. Here we see Atticus Finch as someone who's kind of been in, has resented kind of the New Deal since the late 1930s. And of course, this was true for a lot of Southerners, right? That Southerners embraced the New Deal in 1933, in the year in which the Depression was still intense, in which Roosevelt was promising much needed economic help for the region that remained the poorest, you know, region in the country, the nation's number one economic problem. Roosevelt talks about it in 1938. But by the second administration, after 1936, when Roosevelt tries to pack the court, you know, there is a growing resistance among the South. To, you know, there's a sense that the New Deal is too focused on the urban areas, it's too focused on the North, and it's far too liberal, and it involves far too much kind of centralized power in the federal government. And so you see Southerners, Southern senators, beginning to pull off from that New Deal coalition in 1937, 1938, and into the 1940s. And here in Watchmen, Lee kind of channels a lot of that resentment to the New Deal. She puts it in the voice of Atticus. We had no sense of that in Mockingbird.
Yeah. At one point, we learned that Atticus Finch voted for Eisenhower.
Right.
Up until this point in his life, I would assume, he, like everybody else in the South, was a yellow dog Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. You know, perhaps Atticus voted for Strom Thurmond in 1948 when he ran as the third party candidate for the Dixiecrats. I mean, it's a fictional character. But one of the things we do know about that 1948 presidential campaign is that the name of Harry Truman did not even appear on the ballot in Alabama, that the Dixiecrat forces actually had Thurman named as the official Democratic candidate in the state of Alabama. If you wanted to vote for Harry Truman in Alabama in 1948, you had to write him in. Yeah. You know, so you know, chances are Atticus would have voted for Strom Thurmond. You know, the state went for Thurman in 1948.
But nevertheless, I'm correct that in your piece in the New York Times, you in fact talk about the revelation that Atticus Finch voted Eisenhower as the early beginnings of the South becoming a Republican region of the country.
Well, at one point, Atticus says, I'm a Jeffersonian Democrat. And Scout pushes back and says, I thought you voted for Eisenhower. and then he says, go back to school. You know, and he talks about this kind of Jeffersonian Democratic tradition. But you're right. After 48, the kind of regional orthodoxy of always voting for the Democrats is broken with the third party run. And Eisenhower gets significant support in 1952 and in 1956 in the South. And he wins some upper, he doesn't win any deep South states, but he wins some upper South states.
So let me bring Chuck Reese of Bitter Southerner in at this point to join our conversation. Chuck, you and I have had any number of conversations on this show and then separately from the show about this strange paradox that we who are of the South or living in the South face day in and day out about our history, the bitter history of the South, and what we celebrate about the South. And it strikes me that this book really brings that message home in a very striking way.
Yes? It really did to me. And you know, it was really interesting to me to listen to you talk about, you know, the real political history of what was going on then and the actual context in which the book happened and or in which the book is set. And the thing that strikes me is like, wow, how much history you can live through and not even notice as it's happening, you know? It's just like
Jean Louise is essentially the example of that. Is that right?
Well, she is. And you know, and I'm also talking about my personal experience of reading this book, because I was born in 1961. So grew up seeing kind of the aftermath of the civil rights movement unfold. And that was a pretty enlightening experience for me as a child. But I grew up in a small town in a very middle class kind of family. Farmers and Merchant, and they all voted Democrat, and they were Yellow Dog Democrats. But to know, like, what that really means, it's one thing to read it in the history books, but it's another thing entirely to see it brought to such vivid life in the characters in this book. And that's kind of what blew me away about this book. I mean, I wanted not to like this book. I mean, I wanted not to, because I was a little bit skeptical about the circumstances under which it was released. And because after I heard that Atticus was no longer my hero, I kind of wanted not to like it.
Let me try to set a context and then engage you both in talking about that. We know that Harper Lee submitted the manuscript for Go Set a Watchman to Lippincott, to Tay Hohoff, her editor, in around 1957, we think, was the year that happened. That was Go Set a Watchman.
Right.
It told the story of an Atticus Finch holding the line for segregation at a time when everything was changing in the South. It does not paint a pretty picture of many of the racist people who lived in Atticus' town. So that gets submitted in 57. Tay Hohoff reads it because there's a lot in the book of flashbacks of Scout. Jean Louise is a young girl growing up. She says, rewrite this or write a different book. Write To Kill a Mockingbird. So To Kill a Mockingbird paints an entirely different picture of who Atticus Finch is. We're only speculating. Did Tay Hohoff, can you imagine, think to herself, there's no way that this book, which paints Southerners as racists who use vile language to talk about blacks, is going to be a book that readers will accept? Pure speculation. What do you imagine?
It is amazing, the editorial advice that she got. I mean, the kind of foresight to see that there was a novel there. I do think in reading the book, the flashback pieces, the stuff about her childhood, is the most vivid, you know, and certainly it's very vivid in Mockingbird. But you can also see how the central drama in Watchmen is the revelation that Atticus, her father, who she loves and adores and has always admired, is there with the citizens' councils. How could he do that? And she's so torn up about it. And it's kind of melodramatic and histrionic. And it's, as a reader, if you came to that as the first book, not knowing Atticus, you'd be like, well, why is this so surprising? Why did she have such an idealistic image of her father?
But Chuck, is this a picture of the South that you would have wanted shared with all of the America if it had been published back then?
I completely buy, even though I have no factual basis, none of us have any factual basis to know exactly how all this happened. But, you know, it completely makes sense to me that an editor at a company the size of Lippincott, whose concern is very much driven by putting out books that sell, you know, would think to themselves, particularly given the vivid writing about the childhood that you talked about that was in there, that she would encourage Harper Lee to dive into that more and to find a narrative that would fit better into what the zeitgeist was at the time.
Well, there are some people who would say that the South, when To Kill a Mockingbird was published, which was in the early 60s, needed a hero.
Well,
and that's what Harper Lee gave us, was an Atticus Finch who's a hero.
Well, here's what I'll say about that. I wouldn't trade the world for having read them in the order they came out. Because I really wouldn't. Because the thing about it is that it is absolutely possible to imagine a man like Atticus Finch behaving in the heroic fashion in which he behaved in To Kill a Mockingbird, and in the quite less than heroic fashion that he behaves in Go Set a Watchman. And to be able to see that and to have those experiences separated by all these years, and to have, and particularly to have it come out now, when it seems like the whole country is looking at the legacy, or all these legacies of the South. It was, I finished the book on Sunday and I was kind of like, wow, this is really, you know, not to be too hippie about it, kind of synchronistic.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the conflicting visions of Atticus Finch. Our guest is Joe Crispino, the Jimmy Carter Professor of Southern American and American History at Emory University. And we'll be joined by Chuck Reese, editor of The Bitter Southerner. We first aired this show 3 years ago, right after the publication of Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. If you're just joining us, we're revisiting a conversation I had 3 years ago, just as Harper Lee's novel Go Set a Watchman was published. It caused an uproar because in this second, previously unknown work, Lee showed readers a side of Atticus Finch had never seen before, a segregationist who was a member of the racist White Citizens Council. The conversation's relevant again today because right now, producers of a new play based on To Kill a Mockingbird and set to open on Broadway this fall are being sued by Harper Lee's estate. The estate contends that the script's depiction of Atticus as a bigot early in the play is a disservice to the way he was depicted in Mockingbird. My guests were Chuck Reese, a native-born Georgian and the editor of The Bitter Southerner, who joins us in a few minutes. But first, more with Joe Crispino, the Jimmy Carter Professor of Southern and American History at Emory University. Were either of you struck, as I was, by the fact that a pivotal scene in Go Set a Watchman has Jean Louise sitting in the balcony at the courthouse looking down on the gathering of the White Citizens Council, which is exactly the place she sat to watch her father defend Tom Robinson.
And so, a quiet, humble, respectable Negro who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white people's. The defendant is not guilty, but somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
And here she is in the balcony watching her father in two completely different ways. I found that really kind of chilling.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, clearly she had it in her mind that that was going to be the dramatic setting for the, you know, for the revelation. In Mockingbird, it's the revelation that her father is this amazing, honorable guy who's doing this very controversial thing in the local community. And the other, it's the father is exposed. But in both cases, I mean, that's the setting where the central drama occurs.
Well, you know, and I think one of the things that really makes the book, despite any flaws it has in terms of the technical pieces of the writing, just to have Scout go through this experience of what it means to establish one's personality and to have to break away from the figures we've always idolized in order to become who we're supposed to be. That makes this story like the greatest Southern literature. Because the greatest Southern literature has never necessarily been about the South. Some of the worst Southern literature has been when someone set out to just write a book about the South. But if you look at the work of Flannery O'Connor, if you look at the work of Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Walker Percy, and, you know, the list goes on and on, all of those people wrote stories that were genuinely universal. But they just spoke to Southerners in a particular way, and they ring more true to us because they're from where we come from.
One of the people who seemed most to feel most betrayed by this new depiction of Atticus Finch was Michiko Kakutani, arguably the most important book critic in the country.
She's, arguably?
Well, she's okay. She is the book critic, of course, for the New York Times. She wrote the first review. She had an advanced copy, and I think many of us learned that Atticus Finch was a racist by reading her review several days before the book actually was released. And she said something at the end of her review that I want to share with you and then talk about. She says, one of the emotional through lines in both Mockingbird and Watchmen, a plea for sympathy, as Atticus puts it in Mockingbird to Scout, you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. The difference is that Mockingbird suggested that we should have compassion for outsiders like Boo Radley and Tom Robinson, while Watchmen asks us to have understanding for a bigot named Atticus. In some ways, although Harper Lee in Watchmen tells us how repulsed Jean Louise is about learning her father's a bigot, in many ways the book reads as a defense in the long run of why whites in the South tried to keep blacks from becoming integrated into society with them.
I wouldn't argue that it's a defense of that. I would argue that it might feel like that.
It feels like an acceptance. Louise is asked to accept
asked to accept it. And the fact that we don't know where she's going with that, but that she has broken herself from Atticus at the end of the thing, what that said to me was that, yeah, these things change generationally. You know, they do.
I'm sorry. No. Yeah, I think that there is a sense of kind of regional pride in Watchmen, right? That what she is doing is she is kind of defending Southerners, all Southerners, white Southerners, from the kind of condescension of the liberal North, right? And that this character goes down, she's horrified, yet in the end, the lesson of the novel is that, you know, she might go back and work in Alabama and be a source of you know, good and that she has to have sympathy for Atticus. She can't simply hate him. She has to understand him. And so I think that's part of the novel is that Jean Louise herself, in her fierce reaction, she's kind of parroting the fierce reaction of the liberal North, and she's like, well, wait a minute. I have to understand these people more. And in some ways, it's very much like the Flannery O'Connor story. Everything that rises must converge.
Yeah.
In that story, an old Southern woman, right, is going to her swimming classes on the Atlanta public bus with her son, and her son loathes her, right, and loathes her reactionary politics and how she's in complete rejection of all the changes that are taking place. But at the end of that story, it's the son and the son's self-righteousness and his loathing of his disloyalty to his mother, which is what O'Connor would have us condemn. So I think there's an odd parallel between that O'Connor story and what's going on with Watchmen.
Well, you just, you know, any kind of dynamic like that, all of these things, when they start playing out at the level of family,
yeah,
they get weird.
So Uncle Jack, her Uncle Jack, is certain, I think, it's fair to say, set up as the voice of reason, of wisdom, of moderation in the book. He's the one who she turns to, Jean Louise turns to for counsel and advice. In the long run, he is on Atticus's side. Nevertheless, he's the one who helps her understand life a little bit better. Fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay. So Uncle Jack has a speech in which he very deliberately and carefully tries to explain to Jean Louise that the Civil War, those who think the Civil War was about slavery, don't really understand. You're a professor of American history. How did you feel when you read that section of the book, Joe?
Well, Chuck, when you talked about it being timed well with what things that are happening at the moment, that's the passage I thought about, you know, because we hear in Uncle Jack the classic kind of lost cause defense of the Confederacy and of Civil War memory.
Well, and you know, you got to think about it. It's like, that's what we were taught. Thanks to the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which very soon after the Civil War set out on a campaign to essentially create a revisionist version of Southern history, which is what we were taught. I mean, you know, somebody recently, I saw posted on Facebook some passages from their Alabama high school history textbook. Mm-hmm. Just made pictures of it and put it on Facebook. And some of the things that it said about states' rights and, you know, how the slaves were treated well and that kind of just utter crap, you know, to see it again in a textbook is amazing. And that's like what people were taught. And you think about it, okay, by the time the characters are interacting in Go Set a Watchman, this is a phenomenon that's been going on for almost a century by then, you know, and what people had been taught was just wrong. And what I was taught was wrong.
Did you have the same experience in your education that Chuck's talking about?
I didn't necessarily get in the classroom, but I got it through, you know, the Boy Scouts lowering the flag at a Confederate memorial service at the local cemetery and things like that. You know, it's definitely part of the broader culture.
So it's interesting. Roy Barnes, of course, was in here, and he talked about this notion that the Civil War was not fought for slavery, but for states' rights. Let's listen quickly to what he said.
You know, there was a lot of revisionist history on the Civil War. It started with Jefferson Davis, who wrote a 2-volume set that I've read, that's the driest thing on the face of the earth, called The Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government. And he tried to say that the Civil War was not fought over slavery, which is absolutely ridiculous. I read all these comments, but not for slavery. I have not read one ordinance of secession that ever said, we're seceding from the Union because we don't like the American tariffs. It was all fought on slavery.
Do you imagine that had that book been the one that came first, would the country have accepted this as one of the great American novels? But more important, what do you imagine Harper Lee's reputation would have been?
All I can say is this. I would have idolized her. Speaking truth bluntly is something I've always kind of liked.
But we remember her because she didn't speak it bluntly in Mockingbird.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's one of
the
things.
That's the thing.
I think if this book had been published...
Watchmen.
If Watchmen had been published,
first.
You know, would we have ever had a Mockingbird?
Right.
You know, that's the other thing. You know,
right.
You can't rewrite history.
Do you know
but on the other hand, you know, there are other good, really interesting novels from the mid-50s that, you know, Ellen Spencer's The Voice at the Back Door. You know, that is a book that almost won the Pulitzer. Was nominated by the jury, and then the board turned it down.
Tell us about it.
Well, it's a book that it's about the small town South. And it has a range of characters, black and white, going through the tumult of the times and trying to deal with it. And you know, it's a book that we've forgotten about.
But in part, what we would have said perhaps is, gee, there aren't many Southerners who are willing to tell it like it was in the mid-1950s in the South, is what I think you're both saying, really.
Yeah.
Yes?
And I don't think she'd have gone back to Alabama to live either.
I'll bet she wouldn't have. So I asked each of you if you would find a passage from Go Set a Watchman that you wanted to read for the program. Joe, what section did you pick and why?
So I picked this section about when Jean Louise goes to visit Calpurnia, and there, which is the African-American domestic servant that has served in the Finch home her entire life. And she's going, she just has discovered that Atticus is not who she thought she was. And then she understands too now in this passage that Calpurnia is not who she thought she was. So here I'll just read this. Jean Louise sat down again in front of her. "Cal," she cried. "Cal, Cal, Cal, what are you doing to me? What's the matter? I'm your baby. Have you forgotten me? Why are you shutting me out? What are you doing to me?" Calpurnia lifted her hands and brought them down softly on the arms of the rocker. Her face was a million tiny wrinkles, and her eyes were dim behind thick lenses. "What are y'all doing to us?" she said. "Us? Yes'm, us." Jean Louise said slowly, more to herself than to Calpurnia, "As long as I lived, I never remotely dreamed that anything like this could happen, and here it is. I cannot talk to the one human who raised me from the time I was 2 years old. It is happening as I sit here, and I cannot believe it. Talk to me, Cal, for God's sakes, talk to me right. Don't sit there like that." She looked into the old woman's face, and she knew it was hopeless. Calpurnia was watching her, and in Calpurnia's eyes was no hint of compassion. Jean Louise rose to go. "Tell me one thing, Kyle," she said. "Just one thing before I go, please. I've got to know. Did you hate us?" The old woman sat silent, bearing the burden of her years. Jean Louise waited. Finally, Calpurnia shook her head. So for me, what was striking about that passage is that we see there, you know, we get none of that in Mockingbird, right? Calpurnia is just the kind of classic mammy figure. And of course, there's a long tradition of the mammy figure in Southern culture and in literature. And here, part of what one of the most, I think that's the most dramatic part of the book, because, you know, while Jean Louise is infuriated at her father and the betrayal that he has done, she is heartbroken by this sense that there is this gulf between her and Calpurnia that she never recognized.
And I suspect that for many white Southern children, and for that matter, not just Southern children, for white children anywhere who were raised largely by a black caretaker, a black maid, housekeeper, that experience is not necessarily an unusual one.
Well, it's such a fraught experience. I mean, this is what makes The Help, you know, so complicated, right? This is what happens in The Help. This is the central drama in The Help, is that it's this this young woman who's exactly Jean Louise's age, right? Who realizes there's this world of political knowledge and knowledge within the black community of these domestic servants that she knows nothing about, and she wants to explore it, and she wants to get it down. And through it, her whole world is coming unraveled.
Chuck, you picked a passage that you thought was meaningful. What did you pick and why?
Well, I picked a passage fairly early in the book where Aunt Alexandra, Atticus's sister, is telling Jean Louise why she should not marry Hank. And Hank is a young man who was abandoned by his father and was a friend of Scout's in childhood. And Atticus kind of took him under his wing, and he is now a lawyer in Atticus's practice. But, you know, the thing about it, the reason I chose this passage is that, you know, if you're looking at this book for an accurate portrayal of the way white Southerners thought at the time, there was such an incredible, like, obsession with bloodline almost. Mm. It was almost like people treated family making as animal husbandry. And I just thought this passage was so indicative of the way that those people thought. And I also thought that it was just an incredible passage for the way Jean Louise ends the conversation. So this is in Alexander's voice. "Jean Louise," she said, "I would like to remind you of a few facts of life." "No," Alexandra held out her hand for silence. "I'm quite sure you know those facts already, but there are a few things you in your wisecracking way don't know, and bless goodness, I'm going to tell you. You are as innocent as new-laid egg for all your city living. Henry is not and never will be suitable for you. We Finches do not marry the children of red-necked white trash, which is exactly what Henry's parents were when they were born and were all their lives. You can't call them anything better. The only reason Henry's like he is now is because your father took him in hand when he was a boy and because the war came along and paid for his education. Fine a boy as he is, the trash won't wash out of him. Have you ever noticed how he licks his fingers when he eats cake? Trash. Have you ever seen him cough without covering in his mouth? Trash. Did you know he got a girl in trouble at the university? Trash. Have you ever watched him pick at his nose when he didn't think anybody was looking? Trash. And then the passage goes on, and it ends like this. She's again, the aunt is again talking about young Henry, and she says, "Why, he acts like this house was his own already, and what does Atticus do? He takes it, that's what he does, takes it and loves it. Why, all of Maycomb's talking about Henry Clinton grabbing everything Atticus has." Jean Louise stopped running her fingers around the lip of a wet cup on the sink. She flicked a drop of water off her finger onto the floor and rubbed it into the linoleum with her shoe. "Auntie," she said cordially, "why don't you go pee in your hat?"
She, Aunt Alexandra, then reports to Atticus that Jean Louise has been cursing at her.
I know. I love it, and it's, you know, it's hard to feel any sympathy. I mean, if I were to encounter a person of my age who thought that way today, I would have trouble wanting to hang around with such a person. There were a lot of people in the South who were like that.
So I think that you and Joe agree that the merit of Go Set a Watchman is it has a much more accurate portrayal of what the South was really like in the old SEG days than To Kill a Mockingbird. And if for no other reason, it's an important look at who Southerners really were at that period. And in that sense, a brave book.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And it's not just the fact that it's a brave book. It would have been a tremendously brave book if it had come out when intended. But the fact that it comes out now and under the circumstances it has is, I mean, millions of people are reading this book.
Yeah.
Which means millions of people will be having conversations like that. And that is nothing but a good thing.
I talked with Chuck Reese and Joe Crispino shortly after Go Set a Watchman was published almost 3 years ago. But the question of who Atticus Finch really was is relevant again today as producers of a new Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird fight a lawsuit by Harper Lee's estate. The estate claims that the depiction of Atticus as a bigot early in the play is at odds with the way he's shown in To Kill a Mockingbird. By the way, Joe Crispino has written a book about how Harper Lee shaped the character of Atticus Finch, connecting him to the struggles Lee had with her own father's apparent shifting views on race and the civil rights movement. That book will be published in May, and Joe will be back then to discuss it on Two Way Street. Let's take another break. Two Way Street continues in a moment. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Atlanta's Pearl Clegg is a best-selling novelist and one of the most acclaimed playwrights in the South. She has powerful memories of reading about Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird and sees him as an outlier of his day, a white champion of civil rights in the segregationist South. We talked to Clegg after the publication of Go Set a Watchman to find out whether her views of Atticus may have changed.
I loved Atticus Finch. I love that book. I love that movie. I thought that, you know, he was just a wonderful person with a good heart who understood that bigotry is wrong, that, you know, humans are humans. And I love the book. I love the relationship with his daughter. I remember when she asked him about what is rape, and he says carnal knowledge of another without their permission. And I'm reading this book like in junior high school thinking, what does that mean? Which I'm sure she was thinking too. But I thought the character was wonderful. But I, you know, I understood your interest in the new book of hers. And I've talked to another friend of mine, was a Southerner who was saying he was very interested because he thought that was such an idealized character in Atticus Finch, that he couldn't really believe anybody could be like that. But I never thought of that character as meaning to represent other people. I thought that was a very specific character. He was meant to be special, meant to be distinct, meant to be the one who would sit in front of that jail with a shotgun and say, you're not coming in here to lynch this guy. But that all of those other people who were there with Mr. Ewell for the lynch mob, that to my mind was more what I thought about the American South.
And
so that Atticus was just a... a new way of looking at the possibility of a Southern white male who was not a bigot, which was very important to me growing up in Detroit.
And the fact that Go Set a Watchman has now revealed him to be a bigot. Is that distressing to you?
No, because I haven't read it, and I don't intend to read it. Not because I don't want
to accept
not,
that
it's
person.
Not, it's, and it's not that. It's not because I refuse to accept that he could have been this or he could have been that. I mean, she made that guy up. He's not really Gregory Peck. He's really, you know, someone that came out of her imagination. My reluctance to read the book is more that I don't think at this moment that I have absolute confidence that she was the person who made the decision to put this book out. I think that clearly this was something she wrote many, many, many years ago, and that, you know, I think about drafts of things and early versions of things that I've written, and I say to myself, would I want that to then come back around all those years later so that people can look at it? And if I had absolute confidence that she wanted me to read it, I would read it in a heartbeat, but I don't have that feeling. So I'm glad it sold a million. I hope that that money makes sure that she is comfortable and cared for like a queen till the very end of her days.
So one last question about that. There are people who believe the two Atticus Finches are not really very different at all. They would argue that that's the complicated history of the South, especially after Brown v. Board of Education. It just strikes me that the two different versions of Atticus really, really underline how complicated the history of race is in the South.
Well, I think it's complicated in one sense, but I think it's absolutely simple in the other sense, which is you can't be a good person and support the KKK. Right. You can't do it. I mean, not possible to do that. It's like the whole discussion about the flag. There's so much denial about what happened here, about the buying and selling and breeding of human beings. And that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about Southern heritage like, you know, sweet tea and beaten biscuits and hospitality. That's lovely. But the war was not about sweet tea and beaten biscuits. The war was about the right to buy and sell and breed human beings. And that's wrong. And all of that terrorizing that went on with the KKK and the White Citizens Council, I can't really get my mind around how the Atticus Finch that I met in To Kill a Mockingbird could also be a person who would embrace that. But, you know, authors make very complicated characters. And I'm sure that whatever the writing that she has done, was looking to explore that. But for myself, as a person, not as an author, but as a human being, I got no wiggle room there for people. If you are supporting the White Citizens Council, if you are supporting those bigoted kinds of views that resulted in death and terrorizing and mayhem to African-American people throughout the South for many years, and it continues to this day, then I can't forgive that. So that it's not that complicated, really. It's really very simple. And I think the more we layer on and make it complicated, the more we get away from, is it right or wrong to buy and sell and breed people? Clearly wrong. End of story.
That's about all the time we have for this week's show. Remember, while we love having you join us when we're on the radio, you can catch up with every edition of Two Way Street by subscribing to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We also archive all of our shows on our website at gpb.org/TWS. You'll find almost 4 years of Two Way Streets there. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Our producer is Olivia Rheingold. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.